Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Very happy to have you along on this Thursday, May the 17th. It's about 10 minutes past 8 o'clock now. For breakfast this morning, I had a small serving of shredded wheat, a couple of sliced strawberries, and some skim milk. That's about 4 points. That's 4 points on the Weight Watchers program. I get about 18 a day if I want to lose a few pounds. I'm very accomplished at losing weight and gaining it back, but I'm happy to report I've been pretty successful in maintaining my weight now for about 5 years, maybe a little bit more than that. I had a pretty substantial loss about 5 years ago, and so far so good, but it's a constant struggle. I have to count these Weight Watcher points and juggle food choices and step up my exercise to make sure those pounds don't creep back on. And I'm not alone. Lots of people are watching their weight. According to Consumer Reports this month, 41% of the adult population, some 90 million people, are currently dieting, and they are trying to lose quite a bit of weight, an average of 37 pounds. So we will talk this hour about why that is, why so many of us are so concerned about our weight, why this battle of the bulge seems to be so difficult. We'll wonder if diets really work or not, and whether people who can't lose weight or people who can't keep it off are losers in a different sense. Is this just a lack of willpower, or maybe is there something in our genes? We'll talk all about it with the author of the new book, Rethinking Thin, The New Science of Weight Loss, Myths and Facts of Weight Loss. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Are you in the same boat? Any questions or comments about whether or not there's too much pressure on all of us to be thin in this society? Is it possible for most people to maintain that perfect weight or to be thin? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Our guest is Gina Collada. She is senior writer for the New York Times. She reports on science and medicine. She has won numerous awards for her reportage. And she is the author of several books, including, we talked about this one a couple of years ago, Ultimate Fitness, The Quest for Truth About Exercise and Health, and her latest book, Rethinking Thin, The New Science of Weight Loss, The Myths and Realities of Dieting. Good morning.
Good morning. It's wonderful to be back on the show again.
Yeah, thanks a lot for being with us. I was surprised to read that you were once on Weight Watchers, too.
Oh, I was. It was after my first child was born. It was a while ago, mm-hmm. but I absolutely loved it. I mean, it was crazy because it was the right time to do it. And I always think, when in talking to people and working on this book, that if you kind of really fall in love with a diet, then that kind of helps. I mean, I'm a compulsive person. I do plans for the day and stuff. It sounds crazy. And what I loved about Weight Watchers is I got to write everything down. And I do that, like I do running training now, and I like this website I go to where it gives me a calendar. You do this today, and then I get to check off, did I do it? And with Weight Watchers, I got to check off, did I do it exactly mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And it was different because it was easier for me in a way. I was trying to get into a weight that my body was comfortable with. And in working on my book, I followed dieters in a federal study, and for them, their dream weight was actually kind of low for what their body was comfortable with. And so when I say, oh, it was easy for me, that doesn't mean that what I did, anybody in the world could do, because I was going from an unusually high weight to a weight that was more comfortable.
Yeah. And the reason I said I was surprised to read that is I just know from seeing, your photos, and I remember that you were a runner, and it didn't look like you had a weight control problem.
I actually don't. And mm-hmm. I think that it helps if I've been struggling with my weight all my life, and then I tried to write a book like Rethinking Thin, yeah. I have a feeling people would say, well, she's just trying to make excuses for herself. And because there's so much blaming of people now, they say, you know, if you just had a little willpower, if you just pushed yourself away from the table. And what I was discovering in working on this book, and actually this book grew out of reporting I've been doing for at least 20 years as the science got more and more sophisticated and detailed, explaining what really goes on. As I was working on this book, it became really clear that there's only so far that willpower and pushing yourself away from the table can carry you, that there is a genetically determined range of weights that each individual can hold comfortably. And if your dream weight, unfortunately, happens to be a lot lower than what you are able to obtain and maintain, your body is going to fight back. One guy, just one researcher, described it as the same kind of urge you have to drink fluids if you've been dying of thirst. You know, you just, your body, it feels like it's starving, and it, whether you want to or not, you end up eating. And then people say, oh, I'm a failure. No. I'm not at my dream weight. I can't hold it there. I think of like running. I train all the time, and I could never in my life run a 4-minute mile. I don't care how much I ever train. There is a biological limit, and yet there are people that can just do it.
So there's evidence, scientific evidence, that my genes might be telling me I need to be 160 pounds rather than 135.
Yeah, actually, there's been a lot of evidence, and it first started developing as long as 20 years ago when people started saying, well, let's do the classic kind of genetic studies, where you look at people who were adopted and you say, "What is their weight like their biological parents that they never knew, or is their weight like their adoptive parents who brought them up?" And they looked at people who were adults, age 40 on average, and it turned out their weights were like their biological parents. And then they also looked at twins, which is another classic thing to do. Twins who were identical, twins who were fraternal. Identical twins had body weights that are almost identical, and fraternal twins did not share as many genes, had very different weights. But then they also looked at identical twins who were reared apart. They had weights that were pretty much the same, too. They also did studies, you know, everybody says, and I don't know if people always believe it, but they always say, oh, some people have faster metabolisms. Mm-hmm. That's actually true. They looked at identical twins who were in a study trying to gain weight, which turns out to be really as hard as losing weight. I mean, you can gain weight up to a certain point, but you get up to your upper limit and your body really rebels. And your metabolism speeds up and food is disgusting to you. But these identical twins agreed to try to gain weight. They ate really a lot of excess calories. And the researchers knew exactly how much they were eating compared to how much they needed to maintain their weight. And they could predict, based on how many calories per pound, how many pounds these twins, the people should gain. Well, each pair of an identical twin pair gained the same amount of weight, but the amount they gained really, really varied from like 3 pounds to 25 pounds. Some people really and truly have faster or slower metabolism.
So the message, though, of your book isn't throw out this scale entirely. Don't even try. Don't even worry about it. Just be as big as your body as you feel like being. That's not your message, is it?
Not at all. Mm. I think that there are reasons. First of all, we live in a society where you're judged a lot on your weight, and it would be ridiculous to say that people don't care, because of course you can't not care, because people are always making comments and judging you, and you see this every day. But it's really to say, there are some health consequences for some people when they're overweight, and they often feel more comfortable when they're a little bit lighter. But it's really to say everybody does have this biological range of weights. Most people have been at both ends. I've been at both ends. Mm-hmm. Everybody, almost everybody has. And you know how you feel when you're trying to get too low, when you're so hungry, you go to bed hungry, you wake up hungry, you eat a meal, and it's not enough. You know, no matter how much you eat, you feel like it's not enough. And then that's kind of like that's a signal to you that you really have gone too low. That what happens is your metabolism even slows down to try to put more weight on you. So everything you eat really turns into fat faster than it would have otherwise. If you try to go too low, it's almost impossible. Not impossible, there are people who've done it, but it's almost impossible to keep that weight off. Mm-hmm. And if it comes back on, you shouldn't say to yourself, I'm a failure, I'm a loser, why can't I be thin? Because you can't become arbitrarily thin. Nobody can. I couldn't lose 10 pounds even. I couldn't lose 20, that's for sure. I never could. I know it.
Yeah, I know I can gain 10 pounds on a vacation.
But you probably couldn't gain 50.
Yeah, it's true.
And if you gained 50, you would feel sick. Every time you looked at a plate of food, mm-hmm. would be like eating that last piece of pie after Thanksgiving and then somebody saying, here, have another meal.
Right,
you know,
right.
You wouldn't want to eat.
We're talking with Gina Colata. She is senior writer for the New York Times, who reports on science and medicine. We're talking about her latest book, Rethinking Thin, The New Science of Weight Loss, The Myths and Realities of Dieting. What is your dieting reality? 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Do you think it's just a matter of willpower or lack of it that so many people in this country are overweight or obese? Is it possible to maintain that perfect weight or dream weight? We welcome your thoughts and questions for our guest. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
For more than three decades, Gary Geddes was fascinated by the legend of Hui Shen, a Buddhist monk who fled Kabul for China and eventually ended up in the Americas. In the summer of 2001, Geddes set out to recreate that journey. He joins us today at 3, here on Earth, Radio Without Borders. I'm Jean Veraca.
This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. It's At Issue with Ben Marins this afternoon between 4 and 6. After 5, Ben's guest discusses the decline of the healthcare system in the United States. His guest is the author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. We're talking about the Battle of the Bulge, why it's so difficult for so many of us, and talking about whether or not diets work, and talking about the science of weight loss, the myths and realities of dieting, and welcoming your questions for our guest, or maybe your own experiences. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Gina Colata writes for the New York Times, and she is also the author of the new book, Rethinking Thin. Lots of callers, as I suspected, on this. Gina Colata. Judy and Ripon joins us first. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Joy. I have to say that no matter how much you weighed, your show is still fabulous.
Thank you very much.
I'm a registered nurse, and so I see people, you know, from all walks of life. And the conclusion, I mean, weight gain and loss is so multifactorial, you can't put it on any one factor. I mean, there's so many different things involved, but I think my read on a large percentage of people that have weight problems is that it's probably very similar to what goes on with depression, with the serotonin levels in the brain. There is probably an excess of whatever chemical it is triggering the appetite center, because I can see people who will push their food away, that's enough, and not think twice. And then there are people that just want to eat continuously, and it's like there's something stimulating their brain that is saying, go eat, 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 mm-hmm. eat. You know, and for example, and this is not probably a good analogy because it's the dogs, but they're mammals, and we have two dogs, one that eats constantly and will seek out food to the point where she will steal it off the table. And it's like that dog has food on its brain all the time. The other dog will leave the food bowl half full and walk away. And then the other dog will run and finish it. You know, and it's, you can just see that behavior is very primal. And I think that that's the case in a lot of people. And whether that's a case of their genetics, you know, urging them, eat, 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 you know, that's something stimulating the appetite center of their brain. And you cannot fight that any more than any other form of Mother Nature.
Interesting. Is something in our brains telling us to gorge sometimes, Gina?
That's actually a really great comment. Mm-hmm. And in my book, I give this one extreme example, but it was so dramatic. A girl who was born unable to make this hormone leptin, which tells the body how much fat is on it and sort of is used to signal the body that you need more fat or less. And this girl, without the leptin signal, her body thought there was no fat on it, no matter how fat she got. This girl could not stop eating. Her parents would put locks on the refrigerator. She would forage in the garbage. She would eat anything. Then when they gave her leptin, she was actually one of the few people who had a defect that could be treated with today's knowledge. All of a sudden, they described her weight chart like Mount Everest. It was going up and up and up. She couldn't even walk. She was so fat. And all of a sudden, when she got leptin, it just went down again. She just And now she looks like a normal, slender kid. No problem with her appetite. It was all being driven by this hormonal imbalance. And one of the things that really, really struck with me when I was working on this book was one guy said to me, and I put it in the book, he said, "What makes you think appetite is the same for hunger is the same for everybody?" Which is exactly what your previous caller, the nurse, was just saying. I mean, I thought, that's interesting. We all have different experiences of pain. We smell odors differently. We see colors differently. Why would you assume, I mean, this guy who told me this about hunger, he's a researcher, he studies obesity, he's looking for genetic links, and he's found a number of genes which do make people become fat. The problem is nobody yet knows what to do for these people, but at least he says it's a great comfort to them to say this is the gene defect that's making you want to eat so much. But he said he himself is an overweight guy, and he said he's had these very skinny roommates, and they would come in and say, "Oh, geez, you know, I forgot to eat today." It was like 3 p.m. And then he described them as eating like a few carrots and a piece of celery and saying, "Oh, I feel so much better."
Yeah, those people that annoy
you. And he said, "I can't skip lunch. I'm like the Antichrist if I skip lunch. How can you say I forgot to eat?" Hunger was not the same for them.
Yeah, what about hunger and depression or emotional triggers for hunger?
Well, I think there's no question. These researchers tell me that people do eat or not eat for emotional reasons. Some people under stress lose their appetite. But what was interesting was some of the very original studies original thoughts about overweight and obesity were that people had emotional problems. So there were a lot of studies trying to say, well, what is the emotional difference? What are the problems that are making overweight people eat and normal people not? Turned out there was no difference between overweight and normal weight people. What was happening was that there's some people in every weight group that eat when they're under stress. Some people in every weight group who lose their appetite when they're under stress. Same thing with depression. If you put somebody behind a screen and you said, "Tell me all about your eating behavior and your emotional issues," you wouldn't be able to tell whether they were fat or thin. There was no difference. And that doesn't mean that if you're somebody who responds to stress by eating and you're struggling with your weight, that it's ridiculous to try to get whatever your stressors are under control. Of course it's not. You're somebody who responds to stress by eating. But that's not what made you have this weight problem. I mean, that's not the cause of people getting fat, but it can help to sort of keep you up higher in your weight range than you might have been otherwise.
Yeah. Do you have any explanations as to why, presumably, many more of us in this country are fatter than we used to be?
Yeah, it's a question I get all the time. What happened is, you know, there's no question that people have gotten fatter. On average, they're only about 5 to 7 pounds heavier than they used to be, which is kind of a surprise because we always see these pictures of fat people. And nobody actually knows why people have gotten fatter. I mean, the amount that they've gotten fatter is perfectly consistent with this idea that there's a 20 or 30-pound range that your weight could fall into. But everybody knows, and nobody disputes the idea that genes and environment interact. I mean, it's not like even your height. Height and weight are almost the same in their genetic inheritance. But you know that if you have a poor diet in childhood, you're not going to grow as tall as if you have a better diet, but it's the same genes. So things can be different with the same genetic, exactly the same genes. You can be different depending on your environment. So the question is, what in the environment did it to what make people fatter today than they used to be? And there's all sorts of hypotheses, but nothing is really held up to a rigorous analysis. And so researchers that are looking at this actually say nobody knows, but I feel like every single day somebody, even people unexpected, I mean, I just got an email yesterday from a really well-known and well-regarded researcher who told me that now she, too, is looking at this one thing. They're all looking now prenatally, which is so weird. People have told me that there's been at least 15 studies that showed that that women who smoke during pregnancy have children who become fatter as adults. Mm. There's a lot of studies in animals now saying that what animals are fed during pregnancy affects whether they're how fat their offspring become. And people are starting to say, maybe we are looking at the wrong time. Maybe we're saying, maybe we should look in early childhood. We should look for changes then in the environment. Maybe we should look for changes in what in pregnancy, because apparently, I was just found out this recently, too. It's because it's not my books, but I just learned it recently from somebody else who's studying early influences. He's the guy at Harvard, and he said that babies now are actually slightly lower in birth weight than they used to be. And there have been a lot of studies in animals and people indicating that lower birth weight babies end up fatter as adults. No one knows why. These are all mysteries. Yeah. But I'm just saying that this is such a mystery that why we're fatter, that people are actually looking at unexpected periods, unexpected periods of life to try to figure out what actually was going on, and can anything be done about it?
We're talking with Gina Collada, who is a writer for the New York Times. She reports on science and medicine. She's the author of the new book, Rethinking Thin, The New Science of Weight Loss and the Myths and Realities of Dieting. We're welcoming your questions about the myths and facts of weight loss. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. And we have an open line for you. Renee in Lake Geneva is with us. Hi, Renee, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is dealing with how to make it easier. I mean, there's a lot of myths, a lot of facts, a lot of different diets out there, and I've tried a lot of them. My problem is that heart trouble runs in my family, and I need to do something. But every time I try, either stress, as you were saying before, or something gets in the way, I fall off the diet, and then, you know, you get frustrated, and you don't necessarily want to go back again because you feel, as you said, like a failure. Is there anything that can make it easier? Is there anything that can make it, you know, seem like it's not so much work, but just something that's natural?
I think dieting, at least what I saw when I was working on my book in particular, was really a sort of a dramatic example to me of how, of the joys and frustrations of dieting. Mm-hmm. Besides looking at the research, I also followed dieters in a federal study comparing Atkins to low calorie. And everybody there, you had to be a beast to get into the study, and everybody there had seemed like had been on diet after diet their whole life. And I followed four dieters in particular, and one guy, Carmen, was really great. He actually, it was three men and one woman, which is interesting to me because I followed closely, because usually you hear women talking about weight issues, but these men sounded just, they had the same issues that women have. And Carmen had been on every diet in the world, and it seemed like it was sort of funny to hear him talk, because it was like a diet would almost be magical for him. He was on Jenny Craig, and he lost a whole lot of weight. They wanted to bring him in and as a consultant to sort of show him off in a way. Then he gained the weight back, and then he went on another diet. They went back to Jenny Craig, and the magic was gone. Then he eventually got into the study. He lost a lot of weight the first year, and like everybody else, he had actually pushed his weight too low, and it went back up again the second year, and he said, oh, I'm a failure. Now he went back to Jenny Craig, believe it or not, and the magic is working again. I think part of it might be, you know, if you kind of fall in love with a diet, if you say, this is really working for me, then you get this great pleasure. As one psychologist explained to me, it's like this great pleasure of being in control. It's a real reward system. You feel like, okay, this is it. It's really working. But then if you try to go too low and then your weight mm-hmm. starts to go back up again, that's when people say, okay, now I'm a total loser. You're really not. And I guess after watching these dieters, I would say when you get to the point where you are starting to feel like you have to binge because you can't get enough food, that's a signal to you this is enough. And often for health reasons, you don't need to lose a lot of weight. Often 5 or 10 pounds puts you into a much healthier biological condition. And if you have other health issues like high cholesterol, high blood pressure, there's actually a limit to what weight loss can do. It's very mm-hmm. weird. There was one study that I discussed in my book where one thing you would like to know is if you lost the weight, would your cholesterol, blood pressure, blood glucose go down and stay down or not? And the reason that that's an open question is because so few people go from very heavy to a so-called normal weight and stay there. Nobody does almost. So you sort of can't do that study because you can't get any subjects that actually can hold that weight. But there is one treatment, which is that bariatric surgery where people do lose substantial weight and keep it off. So in this study, they followed people who had had bariatric surgery or not, but they were all very heavy people. And the question was, what happened to blood pressure, cholesterol, and diabetes incidence?
Mm-hmm. Did it go down?
And the first year, while they were losing all the weight, during that physiological state of losing weight, everything was better. The second year, when the weight loss leveled off, the blood pressure and cholesterol went back up again. And there is less diabetes.
Even if they maintained it.
So that mm-hmm. so even though people are told, oh, your blood pressure will go down and your cholesterol will go down, what you'd really like to know is it going down when I'm losing because I'm depriving my body of calories, or is it going down because I weigh less? Even with diabetes, the moment that somebody is on a diet, before you've lost any weight at all, your blood sugar starts to get better. And it can't be the weight loss. It's actually the caloric deprivation that's doing it. So I'm not saying that there's no benefit for anybody to losing weight for their cholesterol or blood sugar or blood pressure. And in fact, with diabetes, doctors talk about like a tipping point where your blood glucose seems okay and you gain another 5 pounds and it's not okay. You lose it again, it'll be okay. You can act, diabetes in particular, if you have a genetic tendency to get it, that can be affected by small amounts of weight loss. But to say, well, I think I'm going to take care of my blood pressure problem by losing yeah. weight, and I shouldn't have to take medications for it, that may not be true, and you may get into much more medical difficulty than if you just say, I'll get it under control, and if weight loss lets me use fewer drugs, that's all the good.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Renee, for the call.
The long answer. I'm sorry.
No, every answer goes on forever. Well, there's a lot of information behind the answers, but what about this? Is there anything easier out there? Is there a pill? Is there something that now is shown to be effective and safe and some kind of diet pill that actually really works?
Yeah, thank you for bringing me to part two of the question. Every time anybody has studied anything in a rigorous way, as opposed to just sort of getting somebody who will get up and give a testimonial, it's always been the same answer. Everything works at first, and everything stops working when people reach their limit of how much weight they can lose. Actually, one person in my book, Jules Hirsch, wrote me an email and said, he's a researcher, he said, the only thing I'm sad about is that there's no solution for people, and I just hope someday you can write volume two. In other words, that's what I was getting at in the beginning. There's no perfect answer. Every diet works. If you love it, if you love writing everything down in Weight Watchers or something, that's the one for you. But one thing I discovered and wrote about was that almost everything that is advised for weight loss and almost every diet was invented as long ago as the 1800s.
Yeah,
and if it worked, people would be doing it.
Right, if I don't love Weight Watchers, but it works for me, it may not be Renee's cup of tea,
yeah,
so to speak.
That's right.
Yeah, Omar in Milwaukee. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to make a comment. I'm an endocrinologist, and I've done some research on obesity also. And I think that one of the things that's happening here is that there is an epidemic of fear about obesity that is extremely overblown. And I don't want to be misinterpreted. I know that there is an increase in obesity and that it's causing an increase in diabetes and so on. But really, most of the health problems are in the extremely overweight people. And there are literally tens of millions of people who are 5 or 10 pounds overweight and who obsess about it day and night and go on diets and lose weight and come back and gain it back. And this may be worse for their health. Just the worrying may be worse for their health than their weight ever was.
Yeah.
And I think it should be all the people who come on the air to talk about obesity should preface the talk with the comment that it's really mostly the extremely overweight people who really are in trouble. Everybody else, if you know, you run, you play, you have a fairly active, natural, healthy lifestyle, you should concentrate on, you know, your relationships and being happy and doing things that you like and not spend your life obsessing about being 10 pounds overweight.
Omar, I love that. I love your comment because one of the things that I also mention and talk about in my book, Rethinking Thin, is exactly that issue. The question is, how dangerous is it really to be overweight? And that's exactly true. In fact, the weirdest thing, which people have so much trouble sort of accepting, but it's shown up in more than one study, is that actually the healthiest weight to be at is what's so-called overweight in terms of your risk of death. That extremely overweight people do have greater health risks, but for them, actually, that's why insurance companies will pay for bariatric surgery, because for them to get down to a normal weight, so-called normal weight, is not a normal weight for their bodies, and they can't do it. So it's a fantastic comment. I think there's so much social stigma about being overweight that it's excused by saying you're at extreme health risk. Mm-hmm. And actually, Omar's right. There's the evidence is just not there.
Yeah, I think I saw some study that said if you had that, you know, a little bit of that slight spare tire, that you were actually better off than if you were extremely thin.
That's actually true. And I guess they don't understand why it is, but one hypothesis is that when you get older and you get a lot of the chronic diseases that people get, when you lose your appetite or you have medical treatments that take away your appetite, you kind of, you know, don't have much. You become very frail when you have no weight that you can safely lose. So those are really good comments. And I guess what I'd like people to do is to think you can be healthy, you can look good, you can exercise, you can be fit, you can do all these things, and you don't have to be arbitrarily skinny. That's more like a fashion statement, just like, you know, I wish I could look like I was 20 years old, but I can't. I mean, there's just nothing you can do.
Our guest is Gina Collada, senior writer for the New York Times, author of Rethinking Thin, The New Science of Weight Loss and the Myths and Realities of Dieting. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hope you stay tuned. Peter Donalds is in for Kathleen Dunn. After 9 o'clock, television networks unveiled their fall lineups this week, and Peter and his guests will preview the returning shows and the new ones. That's coming up. We're talking about whether or not diets work, myths and facts about weight loss, and welcoming your questions for our guest, Gina Collada, who reports on science and medicine for the New York Times, author of many different books. Her latest is Rethinking Thin, The New Science of Weight Loss and the Myths and Realities of Dieting, which, among other things, talks about how there are many genetic and biochemical factors that have a lot to do with how much we weigh, and that those of us who might be overweight, it's not just a matter of a lack of willpower. And Gina Collada, maybe we just need to accept that we're not going to be that absolutely perfectly thin weight of whatever, 125, that the fashion magazines say we're supposed to be?
Well, if I had if I could remake the world, I wish that would really happen. I mean, it's just so hard when you're so much prejudiced against people who are overweight. The people in the study that I was following for my book, Rethinking Thin, were discussing in one of their meetings about the perceptions of overweight people. And they were saying, remember, these people had to be obese to get into the study. And they were saying when they see a fat person on the street, they can't help themselves. They look at them and say, look at that fat person. Can't they get themselves under control? So there's so much prejudice about it. I think that, I guess the message would be that there's nothing wrong with dieting within limits, so you don't get to a point where you feel like a failure and you're starving and you can't hold that weight. But you can look really good, and you can feel good without having to be really skinny. I have a friend who won't buy clothes because she thinks she's too fat and this isn't the real her, and this has been going on for years. You don't have to live your life like that. You don't have to live your life saying, I can't go to a gym because I'm too fat. I mean, people, at the gym don't care what you look like. They're concentrating on themselves, not you. So it's, you know, there's you shouldn't. I wish people wouldn't obsess over it quite so much and be a little bit more comfortable with themselves.
I will admit that I obsess a little bit too much. But does it mean that if my weight wants to creep up, it doesn't? I'm maintaining all right, but it'll jump. Start creeping up, and at around 5 pounds, I'll struggle to take those 5 pounds back off to get down to goal weight, and then it'll jump up to 5 pounds. I'm wondering if my body's telling me it wants to be 5 pounds fatter than it is.
It may be, and it's easy, you know, and you may be, that's why you have to concentrate so much on maintaining your weight loss. But if you're able to do it without feeling physically sort of almost physically ill, then it's you're probably not way too low. There were people who were of normal weight, and they decided that they agreed to be part of a study in which they would lose a lot of weight just for research purposes to see what happens when a normal weight person loses a bunch of weight. Same thing happens to them as happens to the overweight people who lose a lot of weight. These were men, and they dreamed about food. They obsessed about food. One guy during the study was chewing 40 sticks of gum a day. He just he just felt like he had to have something in his mouth. When you get to this point, when the study ended, they were eating like 5,000, 6,000, 8,000 calories a day because they couldn't stop eating. If you get to a point where you just can't stop eating, that is kind of a signal.
Yeah. Angel in Milwaukee. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. My question was on the opposite end of the spectrum. We all know people that can eat all day, that can eat 3-4 times a day and even more, and have these humongous meals, and they will not gain a pound. I mean, and these are the same people, in the case of the men, that go to the gym and try to lift weights and can never get muscle mass. I was wondering on that end of the spectrum, is there any research backing that? Are these people different in any way?
There is research backing it. There are people who require a lot more calories than others. It's not clear why, but they just burn those calories faster, and so they do eat more. It's really true. It's not just some people would say, oh, yeah, you see them eating more, but probably they don't eat the rest of the day. They actually do need more calories, and they do burn more. And the same thing goes for building muscle in the gym. There's a genetic influence on how much muscle you can actually build, and some people can't build, and some people can.
Yeah. Well, you've described my husband, Angel, but is it true that men can lose weight easier, faster than women because of there is a metabolic difference between men and women?
I don't think that that's clear at all, that men often have more weight to lose because they're bigger. I mean, they want to lose more weight. But certainly I would say that the people I was following in the study when I did my book, Rethinking Thin, the men were struggling just as much as the women. They were having exactly the same issues, and you couldn't tell that there was some. And I don't know of any study that shows that men somehow have an easier time of it.
Jim in Decorah, Iowa. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Well, my question kind of follows the one from the fellow in Milwaukee. For people who are very, very thin, is it simply a matter of calories, that they need to eat more calories? You've kind of addressed it in saying that some people genetically just are going to be thin. But for the person, there are people who want to lose weight. There are also people who want to gain weight. And what would you recommend for that person?
Well, it's just as hard to gain weight as it is to lose weight. And there were studies, again, it's so funny because people have tried every single variation of weight gain and loss studies in a rigorous way over the years. And there was one famous study where a researcher said he wanted to take normal-sized people who'd never had a weight problem and see if he could make them get obese or really overweight. And first he had students who volunteered, and they couldn't do it. They actually could not do it. Finally, he did the study at the Vermont State Prison with prisoners who volunteered, and they got special privileges for it. But they had to have their attendants sort of standing over them, watching them to sort of see if they could actually get that food into themselves. And it was really, really hard. When the study ended, they were fat, but they couldn't stand the thought of food or the sight of food, and their metabolism really speeded up to try to get rid of those calories. So they were burning like 25% more calories than they would have if they had been naturally, quote, naturally that fat. And as soon as the study ended, the weight just fell off of them. So when you get up to the top of your range, your metabolism speeds up. When you get to the bottom, your metabolism slows down. You're always being pushed into that range. So it's really, really hard to gain weight. And people who say, oh, I could just gain weight, those lucky skinny people who are trying to gain weight, it's really hard for them too. And the advice is always the same, that there's a biological limit to how much you can gain or lose, and without enormous, almost superhuman effort, which may be impossible to sustain, and you kind of have to respect those limits.
Thanks, Jim. Sarah in Green Bay, hello, you're on the air.
Hi. You know, referring back to what you were just saying, you know, I guess I've been listening to many callers, and I watch people around me who are just constantly fighting with weight. I can't lose weight. I'm working with a trainer. But then I also watch them devour just foods and foods and foods and foods, and I look at them like, you're not making healthy choices. And then, you know, is it not, you know, I always believed it's what you're, basically you are what you eat, and it's what your calorie, what you're taking in for calories a day. You can't take in 5,000 calories and, you know, think that you're going to, without exercising or being active, and burn it off. I mean, is that not true?
Well, it's true to a certain extent. The question is, why are these people so hungry? I mean, you couldn't eat, probably. You probably couldn't eat 5,000 calories a day, day after day. Mm-hmm. You really would. You'd be sick. You just couldn't do it. So why are they so hungry? Something is driving them to eat. And I think that what all the research says, that what it is that their body is demanding those extra calories to keep a certain level of fatness. That's why they're so hungry. That's why that one researcher said, why do you think hunger is the same for everybody? It's really not. I mean, when you see what somebody eats and you say, how could they do that to themselves, they may not want to do that to themselves. In my book, I describe this one woman who was desperately trying to lose weight. She eventually ended up with bariatric surgery, but she was talking about what it felt like. She was eating very little. She was really, really rigorously trying to control her diet and spending forever at the gym on the elliptical cross trainer and trying to burn up calories. But then she would have this incredible urge to eat. And when she started to eat, she said it's like she couldn't stop. Nothing ever filled her up. So I think that's what you're seeing. There's this, you know, there's more going on than just making the wrong choices. The choices they're making are really full of calories because their body is demanding calories, calories, calories to get some fat on, more fat on it.
But, I mean, I from my own personal experience, I remember thinking some years ago, I don't understand why I'm, you know, putting on all this weight, or why I'm as big as I am. I don't eat all that much. I, you know, it's not fair, and it must be my metabolism. But
well,
then when
it
I went,
is.
But then when I did go on weight, I realized that my portions were a whole lot bigger than they probably needed to be.
Well, that's because you really can. You can control things within a certain range. I mean, I don't want to say there's nothing that you can ever control.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying that there's kind of a limit to how much you can control.
Mm-hmm. Laura in Manitowoc. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. Two things. First of all, don't you think it really has a great deal to do with what calories you're taking in? There's a fantastic book by Paul Stitt from Natural Ovens, Why Calories Don't Count. And he talks about you know, not being concerned with the numerical value of the calories that you're taking in, but what kinds of calories you're taking in. In other words, if you take in 5,000 calories in carrots, that's different than taking 5,000 calories in ho-hos. So the choices really do matter. And secondly, I think that we need to do a rethinking also about our body's response when we are losing weight. In other words, if you're eating well, and you have that hunger and those cravings, don't starve yourself. Of course your body's going to go into this overdrive, give me calories, but give it good calories and almost embrace that feeling of hunger, you know, within reason. I mean, you don't want to be having this sensation that you're starving to death and not respond to it, but that feeling of hunger is telling you that, okay, this is working. You are burning those calories. You are losing weight.
Mm-hmm. I don't know of anything that showed any study that's ever showed that calories are different. They actually have done studies where they gave people in the hospitals, they could totally control it. different compositions of diets, all fat, no fat, various amounts of carbohydrates. Now, you can't do every variation in the entire world, so I don't want to ever sort of dismiss things out of hand, but certainly within limits, saying if you have an all-protein diet, an all-fat diet, or various combinations, does it make a difference to how many calories you're using every day? And it actually didn't make a difference. That doesn't mean that you can't make really good food choices or really bad food choices, and that some food choices are not are healthier. You know, obviously some are not obviously, yeah. but some are healthier than others. But I'm not sure that you can just say if I chose the right foods, I could eat the same number of calories and I would lose weight.
What about, and we're running a little bit short on time, but all this stuff we read about the glycemic index of foods, does that make a difference?
Not that I'm aware of. Mm-hmm. In terms of how fat or thin you're going to be. But I don't, once again, I never want to dismiss things out of hand. There might be things out there that are just totally convincing that I just haven't heard about.
Rich in Stevens Point. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. Hello?
Yes, please go ahead.
Yeah, well, you kind of made my day because I found out about 15 months ago I was diabetic and I was went on a very strict diet and the number for a diabetic, normal for the A1C is 4 to 6, and I was 8.5, and in 3 months I went to 5.8, so I was down in the normal range. Now this year I'm doing exactly the same thing, but my number is moving up. And you pretty much explained the whole thing, that it went down when I was losing weight last year. And it was just a very good explanation of what's happening to me.
But that doesn't mean that Rich should just forget about it, right, Gina?
Well, not forgetting.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I'm doing exactly the same thing as I was last year, except that I've lost 25 pounds, and you know, my A1C was in the normal range, and my blood sugar each day is just a little higher than it was last year, and that was frustrating me.
Mm. I guess, you know, if it were me, I would make sure that I was being seen by an endocrinologist who could help help you with whatever medications would help you control your blood sugar, because it's a difficult disease. I understand it, it's a difficult disease to manage, and there's lots of options. But you sort of need an expert to sort of help you, and I'm sure you're doing that.
Yeah. Rich, thanks very much for the call. And in 30 seconds, any last words of wisdom, Gina Colletta, for those of us who are rethinking thin?
Well, I hope that people will. There's a lot of information, and there's a lot of information in history and sociology in my book that I could never get to in our conversation today. But I love talking to all of your guests. They brought up fantastic questions. And it was really an eye-opener for me to work on this book, because even though I thought I understood what science had said and what it's really like to try to lose weight, there's nothing like being with people, following them, and seeing how the science plays out in real life.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It was wonderful. Thanks.
Gina Colletta, senior writer for the New York Times, author of Rethinking Thin, The New Science of Weight Loss and the Myths and Realities of Dieting. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing the hour and to Leo Duran for on-air production. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.